Good evening to you, and welcome to the show, History and You, with George Rodriguez Walling.
Good evening, and welcome to the show, History and You, the show where you decide what history becomes. I am your host, George Rodriguez Walling, and I am very happy to be here with you this evening. If you want to call in and contribute your thoughts, please do so at toll-free 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Please call and tell me your views. If not, send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. You'll find me at bbsradio.com/historyandyou. That's bbsradio.com/historyandyou. Tonight's show is brought to you by the folks at FX Software and Sweet Pea, Women's Apparel by Stacy Frati. Tonight's topic, Our Man in Havana, Fitzhugh Lee. The Chinese have often said, may you live in interesting times. Clearly, Fitzhugh Lee, nephew of the Confederate icon General Robert E. Lee during the War of the States, and Consul General for the American government in Havana throughout the Spanish conflict over Cuba, did indeed leave all of us an indelible mark of character and duty to his country. It also makes me wonder as to the caliber of our public officials we have today. Like Major General Lee, there have been so many others embedded in the soul of America's history, which have also made this country what it once was, and some would even argue what it still continues to be today, great. Well, a debatable point. Here to discuss the quality of greatness among American figures is a woman who began college at the age of 40. Interestingly, she found her passion while attending a required history class at Los Angeles Valley College. After transferring to California State University at Northridge, she earned a bachelor's degree and then a Master of Arts degree in history by the year 2007. The topic for this evening's show is based on her first published book entitled Fitzhugh Lee, The American, the symbol of reunion and redemption. Ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pleasure that I present Miss Peggy Arendt. Welcome to the show, Peggy.
Why, thank you. Good to Peggy, be here.
Thank you. Thank you. Very nice to have you. Peggy, I read your book and found it to be a very interesting piece of work. Very, very insightful. Tell us, if you would, please, what was it that inspired you to write about Fitzhugh Lee?
Well, I was doing research in college for my master's, and it was on the Spanish-American War, and I was working with a professor whose specialty was Southern history, and he wanted to, you know the South's view of what happened. And I eventually came, you know, his name kept popping up, and I came across this wonderful article in the newspaper where a man named General Lee comes home from Havana, Cuba, and is a hero. He gets a hero's parade. And that just made my jaw drop to the ground. And it's like, what?
Yeah.
Never heard that before.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, everybody has heard of Robert E. Lee, the famous Confederate general, but not too many people have heard about Fitzhugh, or affectionately known also as the Flea, based on the findings and research of your book. Why the title, The American, and the words reunion and redemption? But let's start with the word American. Why the American? Did you decide to use that phrase in relation to Fitzhugh Lee?
Because after the occupation of Cuba, he was there. He was one of the commanding generals. And after he left there, he was honored throughout the country. And it was a newspaper account of what happened in Colorado, Denver, Colorado. He was introduced before a large crowd, as did Q. Lee, the American.
Right.
And go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No, finish.
Yeah, and, you know, the newspapers, even it was either the New York Times or the LA Times, I don't recall which right offhand, said that, you know, that Q. Lee was no longer a son of Virginia. He was America's son.
Right. And that's what I figured, because by selecting the word American, it seems as if you chose it, putting in a lot of thought to it, like, this is a man that does not always represent himself by Virginia standards, but by nationwide standards. He is a man of the people, a person like what Andrew Jackson once was, a president of the people, a person that has a lot of qualities in terms of grassroots, in terms of really knowing and feeling the general pulse of the population, what they needed, what they wanted, what disgusted them, what inspired them, what moved them, what made them be. And this man seems to bring out a lot of what an American is about, at least in the 19th century. But what about the words reunion and redemption, right alongside with the overall title?
Well, because he was basically carrying on for his uncle to, because Robert E. Lee once said that the salvation of the nation rested in reunion, and Lee just worked towards that, and his actions in Cuba led to that.
Yeah. Well, I imagine the word redemption there, the motive for selecting it is that, you know, the South has always done things right. The result of the war was just a different kind of result, but not necessarily a wrong one. But there will be a sense of redemption. There will be a sense of us coming back and doing something notable and doing something memorable. Redemption. We will redeem whatever needs to be redeeming through the leadership of the quality American that was seen by so many within Fitzhugh Lee.
Well, it was also the reunion, the first war where the North and South fought side by side. And basically, it was the redemption of the South, proving that people from the South could be loyal Americans.
Right.
And that's
right.
Why redemption.
Right. As a student, Fitzhugh wasn't, shall we say, the most exemplary type of student at West Point when he was there. Might I say, perhaps mediocre at best, particularly he was forced to do a lot of things that he really didn't want to do. He got into a lot of trouble. He accumulated an awful lot of demerits based on your findings and your research. So my question in relation to this one particular point is, are most students who are mediocre at best in early schooling, and mind you, I know that Fitzhugh accelerated a lot in certain areas, tactics and cavalry tactics and things like that, but in other areas, perhaps mediocre at best, for those students who demonstrate that kind of mediocrity, do they usually manage to turn that mediocrity into greatness? Can we make a general rule about that, or not really?
It depends on whether they find their calling, so to speak. I mean, Fitz was basically born a military man. He was born into a military family.
Yes.
His father was in the Navy. His uncle was an Army officer. He lived the life as a child as, you know, an Army brat, and he really liked that, and that's what he excelled at.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, even though he was mediocre otherwise, he found what he could do the best.
Yeah, yeah. Do you want to compare the qualities of bravery and leadership back then to today, according to today's standards? Is there a do you see a difference?
I see more honesty back then. More, well, chivalry is what they used to call it, you know, especially in the South.
Yeah, more of a sense of honor.
Yes, and honor, duty, and, you know, respect for, you know, the people you were fighting, who, you know, the civilians and the people you were fighting against, because he fought against, you know, friends, people he knew at West Point, you know?
Yeah, no, I know, and I remember reading through parts of battles where he would capture certain Union people, and he'd go into their camps, and they would all socialize, and they would say hello to each other. I started laughing when I came across that part of it. And of course, it's understandable, because he was in West Point with all these guys, and now he has them incarcerated as the parameters of war changes suddenly, and Fitzhugh sees himself in an entirely different set of circumstances. But leadership, I would suspect also, I would agree with you, Peggy, that it had a different concept altogether. Leadership meant, I think, a whole lot more in different contexts back then than it is today, which leads me into the next thing that I wanted to ask you. How do these qualities compare to an Obama leadership in foreign affairs, for example?
Different
how?
Well, I think Fitz would be upset that Guantanamo's still open, that, you know, now we're going with drone strikes, you know, hitting, bombing people, you know, wedding parties, children, innocent people. I don't think he would like that. I think he would be very outspoken about that.
I would suspect that he would say that America somehow has lost its backbone to do certain things. How do you see the United States today, for example?
I see that we lost our soul. We are not the greatest nation in the world.
I think that calling has been left behind a long time ago. The fact that we have lost a lot of the leadership that we had in the world at one point. Even today, with the Obama leadership, and I compare it to Fitzhugh Lee within foreign affairs, because Fitzhugh Lee did a lot. He contributed a lot in foreign affairs as well with the issue of Cuba. And yet he always managed to keep the interests of America as the forefront leading element above personal gain or anything else. And now American leadership has transformed its conceptualization somehow.
Yeah, he also, in Cuba, tried to promote the interests of the Cuban people, but it was the McKinley administration that really didn't want to hear it. You know, they wanted to do what they wanted to do, but Fitz was, they just didn't listen to him, what Cuba needed, what the Cuban people needed. And American interests were basically like they are today, the rich, big corporations. You know, they go in and they bought land really cheap, harvested crops and all that, you know, just took everything they could out of Cuba.
Yeah. And speaking of presidents, in terms of character and leadership, what kind of a person was Grover Cleveland when compared to William McKinley?
Cleveland, he just didn't what I don't know all that much about Cleveland. What I do know is that he didn't want to interfere in Cuba. He was just kind of like, no, I don't want to do it. I think he knew he wasn't going to be president for very much longer, which is what happened. So he just didn't want to get involved with, trying to oust Spain from Cuba.
Yeah. Well, actually, I see both of them as having somewhat of a soft approach toward the foreign policy issue of Cuba in particular. Cleveland in particular is somewhat of an interesting figure among American presidents, because you know that Cleveland served two terms, but they were not consecutive terms. They were two non-consecutive terms, which I'm not really sure that everybody is aware of that. But aside from that, Cleveland stands out as seeming to soft pedal and express with caution the idea of how America should advance forward into the world, dare I say it, within an imperialistic disposition, shall we say. Okay? But yet, when it came to the Americans beginning to populate the Hawaiian Islands, and people like Steve Dole, governor down there, and others that made up the American cadre started controlling more and more among the native Hawaiian populations, to the point where they even incarcerated the queen, Liliuokalani. Cleveland had a real problem with that. He had a problem with going too far as America being imperialistic. And so he absolutely insisted that the queen be released. And to his own astonishment, they turned him down. They told Cleveland, "Mr. President, we cannot do that." Okay, which I find very, very interesting. When you now link it up to the issue of Cuba, I'm sure that Hawaii is standing somewhere in the back of his mind in terms of somewhat of a similar experience. Are we in there, based on what you said, imperialistic motives, or are we there to really help the rebel force there, the insurgents, the native Cuban population that are being, for all intents and purposes, slaughtered by the Spanish?
Yeah, it was the rhetoric to gin up to the war was basically, oh, look at the people of Cuba, they're starving, they're dying. Oh, we got to go and help them. But after the war, it was, imperialistic.
Yeah,
take
yeah.
resources and yeah. and just feed the rich and yeah. through the people of Cuba.
Yeah, and I think that McKinley was a little bit more forward in his willingness to show a little bit more of a assertive disposition, shall we say, in his approach toward Cuba. McKinley, I think, was more flexible and lent more of a free hand to Fitzhugh Lee in doing whatever he felt was needed to be done, while Cleveland, I think, held a little bit more reservation as far as what Fitzhugh Lee should do or not do, especially according to Cleveland's Secretary of State. I believe his name was Richard Olney.
Yes.
I have one more question to ask you, Peggy, before we go on break. But I think it's an interesting one to reflect comparatively the United States back then and the United States today. To what extent, Peggy, do you feel that Spain, back in the years 1897 and 1898, reflect the United States today? Well, I'm asking this because you probably know only too well that Spain during that time period was pretty much on a slippery slope. Okay, I mean, civilizations come and go, but it's a gradual slope. And Spain, since the beginning of the 19th century, all the way on through to the end of that 19th century, Spain has been declining steeper and steeper into that slope. Some people would argue on a comparative basis that the United States is beginning to experience something similar. And so this is why I wanted to ask you an extent-oriented question. To what extent, in your opinion, do you feel that Spain back then in 1897, 1898, reflected what the United States may be today?
Yeah, I think it seems like we're in decline. The Spanish, they had religious fanatics really bad back then, and we seem to have them right now. And, you know, Spain used to be a superpower, and they declined to the point where basically Cuba and a few other places around the world was all the empire they had left. And it seems like America, you know, were declining.
Yeah.
Since it was a slippery slope, but I don't think we're going to lose, you know, territories. But, no. You know, like Puerto Rico, Guam, whatever.
Right. But we do seem to be reflecting some kind of a decline economically, socially, militarily, in foreign affairs, in other areas that perhaps are no less important.
Yes, Spain used Cuba to keep the treasury. You know, they were continually bankrupt, and they just used Cuba to boost up the treasury through, you know, sugar crops, tobacco crops, whatever else they had there.
Yeah.
Just, you know, it was an economic lifesaver for Spain at the time. Kind of like how maybe China is to us now, or some of these other places that market cheap goods and send them over here.
Yeah.
For kind of an economic lifesaver here.
Peggy, let's discuss some of the particulars about the book. But first, let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Peggy Arendt and our topic for this evening, Our Man in Havana, Fitzhugh Lee, on History and You. In just a moment. Just break it down. We build it up just to break it down.
In a world dominated by frameworks, platforms, and tools, it's difficult to know how to win when the only certainty is change. At Software FX, customer service and highly useful products are our main goals. Over 20 years of experience, coupled with ideas and inspiration from more than 150,000 developers all over the world, have turned into business intelligence tools that provide more choice, convenience, and value to our customers and partners. Yes, technologies do change, but Software FX has your back. That's Software FX, data visualization for every need, every platform. Call us today, toll free, at 1-800-392-4278. That's 1-800-392-4278. Be the master of your data. Software FX. Sweet Pea by Stacey Frotte is a woman's contemporary clothing line and nationally recognized brand. Sweet Pea is an innovative collection that pairs flirtiness with sensibility. Our Sweet Pea woman can be running a board meeting, watching a soccer game, or dining out with friends. Sweet Pea is recognized to be eye-catching and edgy. We empower our loyal worldwide customer base by creating clothing that fits their lifestyle. She is on the move and believes that Sweet Pea is her go-to on almost all occasions. Day into night, Sweet Pea's stylish blouses move with you and your busy day. Bloomingdale's, Nordstrom's, Anthropologie, and the Sweet Pea by Stacey Frotte website feature new Sweet Pea designs weekly. We have been creating beautiful clothing for 16 years, and there is no sign of us slowing down. Fashion is cyclical, it is true, but style is a constant. Please visit www.sweetpeabystacyfrody.com today.
Okay, and we are back with Peggy Arendt discussing our topic for this evening's show, Our Man in Havana, Fitzhugh Lee on History and You. Peggy, you finished chapter 4 in your book in particular, page 47, I even remember the page, with the line, and I quote, "On the day of the inauguration, Cleveland warned William McKinley that Consul General Fitzhugh Lee was not to be relied upon," quote unquote. Why? What was it about Lee that provoked that opinion?
I think Cleveland was concerned that Fitz was trying to start a war, or at least only was.
Yeah, that could make sense. What do you base that hunch on? Did he try to do something or speak in a certain way or address an issue a certain way that might have precipitated that possibility?
Well, he did ask the Cleveland administration to have a ship ready, like a battleship ready down in Key West in case, you know, things got awfully hairy in Havana.
Yeah.
And the administration said, no, we're not doing that, you know. And at one point, you know, Olney writes him back, what are you trying to do, start a war? Man. He's like, no, you know, I don't like war, is basically what he said.
Yeah, yeah.
He's seen too much of it.
Yeah. The case of Dr. Ruiz is something else that I wanted to touch upon with you, Peggy. It was a tragedy, as interesting of a read as your book was, when I came to that part, it was particularly riveting, especially the way you go into describing how he wrote the names of his family members, his wife, his kids, writing their names in blood. And it was all very, very tragic. Would you please explain to our audience the details of that tragic situation, please?
Well, he was accused by the Spanish of trying to blow up a train, I believe it was. And he said, no, I didn't do it. And the Spanish didn't want to hear that. And they tortured and beat him to death, is basically what they did.
Wow. And was the issue of him being an American citizen finally legitimate, or was it fabricated?
Well, according to what I found, he was a naturalized American, meaning he came from Cuba to America, took whatever test you need to take to become an American, so he became an American citizen, and then afterwards he went back home to Cuba. While he was in America, he learned how to become a dentist, and so he went back to Cuba to be a dentist. And like I said, the Spanish accused him of trying to being, you know, like a terrorist. But so, you know, they beat him.
You know the issue of yellow journalism. I don't have to tell you. I'm sure you're well familiar. Sensational journalism is still practiced today, as we know, in all of our media sources. But my question in relation to yellow journalism is this. Is what happened to Dr. Ruiz a good case for yellow journalism, or should it have been left alone in consideration for the privacy of his family?
To me, his wife was okay with it. You know, she wanted people to know what had happened to her husband. I mean, afterwards, she ended up coming to America and talking with the president himself. And, you know, I don't know if she stayed here. you know, so, finish off her life.
So it was an opportunity to get the word out and let not only the Americans know, but as much of the world as possible at that time, look at what the Spanish are doing in Cuba. Look what the Spaniards have done to my husband. Look what the Spanish crown has done to my family.
And it was also, look what the Spanish have done to American, to an American citizen.
Exactly. Is this kind of yellow journalism then justified, even though it is sensationalism? Is it justified?
I don't think the story was sensationalized. I think what I have in my book are the facts.
Okay.
That's what happened. It's not like, I don't think it was blown out of proportion at all.
Yeah, it's not a fabrication, in other words.
Yeah. You know, it's like, I don't know. I don't know. You...
Peggy, sometimes measures and policies that are taken in such circumstances, a colonizing power over a people that are subjugated and brutalized and sodomized and everything else is always a hateful scenario to consider. But sometimes when excessive policies run amok, it has its consequences, the same way that softer policies also carry their consequences. So I want to ask you about whalers' policies, reconcentration policies. We know that it was brutal. We know that his policies were unconscionable. But in comes now, at this point, General Blanco y Eranas. Was the policy of General Blanco y Eranas a sign of Spanish weakness and decline, or was it simply a clever strategy after the severity of Weyler to win over the insurgents? Which of the two do you think it might be?
To win over the insurgents. Yeah. Spain had been in Cuba for like 400 years, and their brutality started from the beginning. The native people that were on the island were basically exterminated.
Yeah.
And then they brought in African slaves
Yes.
to, you know, do stuff, you know, do the crops and stuff. And, you know, it's just a long, brutal history in Cuba. And America was screaming for reforms from Weyler, and he just wasn't doing much, so... Spain eventually listened and got somebody, you know, more a gentle, kinder.
The only problem that I have with something like that, Peggy, is when you point out that there were so many decades of brutal policies against the native population there in Cuba. For so long, and it was so consistently brutal and cruel, that now suddenly you have this other guy, Blanco y Eranas, coming in as a general, substituting what was once a radical, I can't think of any other word, perhaps extreme, substituting this extreme policy for another far extreme policy, but in being much more benevolent. The amount of time factors in here, because if you have 90 years of brutality and then 4 years of benevolence, does that seem to be clever? Does it seem to have the forecast of having it work out, that the insurgents are really going to understand this?
No, and it wasn't 90 years. It was 400
Yeah, no, I just use that as a blank example, not using it factually or anything like that, no.
Yeah, people have been brutalized for centuries. You know, you can't expect them to, oh, we got a new guy, and, oh, everything's all better. It doesn't work that way because the insurgents didn't stop with, General Blanco. They still fought. They wanted the Spanish out.
Yeah.
So, you know, doing reforms and being nicer about it, just it was way too little, way too late.
Yeah. The issue of the Maine is still an issue, even in history books. The Maine is still shrouded in mystery. And you mention it plenty in your book, and with good reason. Should it be? Should it be continued to be shrouded in mystery?
No, it shouldn't. What we need, well, they found the back end was hauled out to sea, I believe it was 1912, and National Geographic, I don't know how many years ago, found that and examined it. But the bow of the ship is still at the bottom of Havana Harbor.
Wow.
What we need is National Geographic or somebody to go into Havana Harbor and look at the bow of the Maine to try to find a final answer as to what happened. But, you know, Cuba's the bad guy now. They have been for a while, and I don't even think Americans are allowed to travel to Cuba.
No. The other issue that I wanted to bring up is runs along the insulting. What's your opinion, Peggy, of Delamay's letter about McKinley? Do you think that it was entirely accurate?
Oh, Delome?
Yes.
Delamay? I don't know how to pronounce it. It was, I don't know, it seemed to be propaganda.
Interesting. Propaganda to favor who, the Americans or the Spanish?
The Spanish. Spanish were saying, oh, we're good people, we're chivalrous people. You know, it's America that's evil. You know, same kind of thing that has been going on in today's world. You know, America thinks they're, you know, all that in a bag of chips, but look at those people over there. In that country, they're garbage, and basically that's what the Delome letter was.
Well, I saw the letter in a slightly different context because the letter probably as accurate as it was in part a put down against McKinley. And trying to tell him that he really didn't have much of a backbone in terms of wrestling and deciding with the really tough issues. And I sort of began to see this possibly as a kind of propaganda that would favor and fall right into the hands of the Americans so that the Americans can show the American media, look who drew first blood here. And that's sort of the way I can take a look at it, and I'm wondering if I take a look at it that way, how many other people might also take a look at it both ways, the way that you expressed as well as the way that I expressed it.
Well, I think at the time most people probably took it the way you take it. You know, I'm glad you said that because that's part of it too. The only people who looked at it my way or both ways would be the anti-imperialists here in America, which, you know, now we're basically silent, kept silent, made silent. I don't really know the entire story there, but, you know, they were ignored, basically.
Yeah. Peggy, I want to discuss whether the United States wanted Cuba for colonial purposes like Spain did. Or did she fight for Cuba to really help the insurgent cause, to really help the Cubans? But first, let's take another quick break, and we'll be right back with Peggy Arendt and our topic for this evening,
our man in Havana, Fitzhugh Lee, on History and You in just a moment.
In a world dominated by frameworks, platforms, and tools, it's difficult to know how to win when the only certainty is change. At Software FX, customer service and highly useful products are our main goals. Over 20 years of experience, coupled with ideas and inspiration from more than 150,000 developers all over the world, have turned into business intelligence tools that provide more choice, convenience, and value to our customers and partners. Yes, technologies do change, but Software FX has your back. That's Software FX, data visualization for every need, every platform. Call us today, toll-free, at 1-800-392-4278. That's 1-800-392-4278. Be the master of your data. Software FX. Sweet Pea by Stacey Frotte is a woman's contemporary clothing line and nationally recognized brand. Sweet Pea is an innovative collection that pairs flirtiness with sensibility. Our Sweet Pea woman can be running a board meeting, watching a soccer game, or dining out with friends. Sweet Pea is recognized to be eye-catching and edgy. We empower our loyal worldwide customer base by creating clothing that fits their lifestyle. She is on the move and believes that Sweet Pea is her go-to on almost all occasions. Day into night, Sweet Pea's stylish blouses move with you and your busy day. Bloomingdale's, Nordstrom's, Anthropologie, and the Sweet Pea by Stacey Frotte website feature new Sweet Pea designs weekly. We have been creating beautiful clothing for 16 years, and there is no sign of us slowing down. Fashion is cyclical, it is true, but style is a constant. Please visit www.sweetpeabystaceyfrotte.com today.
Okay, and we are back with Peggy Arendt discussing our topic for this evening's show, Our Man in Havana, Fitzhugh Lee, on History and You. So, Peggy, did the United States want Cuba for colonial purposes, just like Spain, or did she fight to really help the Cubans?
Neither. Well, they did fight to free Cubans from Spain, but I don't think the president or anybody else in the country was interested in making it a colonial power, making it part of a colony, or annexing it, or anything. A lot of that had to do with racism, actually, because at the time Americans were saying, "Oh, they're brown people. We don't want those kind of people voting here in America. It could upset everything." Because, back then, racism was a lot more prevalent than it is today.
Yeah, so. I would agree with that. And as a matter of fact, there were groups of people in the United States, at this one particular time, too. I'm not necessarily running away from the time period, but it was during this time when the Americans were fighting the Spaniards, not only in Cuba, but also in the Philippines, when a lot of people feared what became called mongrelizing the population. In other words, mixing races between native Filipino people with Anglophiles here in the States. I think to some degree a similar concern was spread among Hawaiians and mixing races with the native Hawaiian population when the Americans were there under predominantly the Grover Cleveland years. I think that's always been a concern. And in the States, there were leagues, the Imperial League, other organizations that were bent on putting an end to that, as well as advocating that and welcoming it. I know for a fact that Andrew Carnegie was one who welcomed a lot of the Filipino people, not necessarily because he was a big fan of mongrelizing the American population, but because it represented cheap labor for him. It was a very pragmatic approach to the problem. And like that, there were many pragmatists of the time that saw racism in the way that it was most practical for them. But be that as it may, I think that I would agree with your answer in that it was, a little bit of both. When we imperialize or when we take on similar dispositions, I think that we show and rear up an ugly head now and again, as well as a more humane head. Because after all, we did also clean up a lot of what the Philippine Islands left behind. More organized government, better schooling, improvement in sanitations, and we did the same thing in Cuba. Peggy, if someone were to ask you, what is the argument of your book, looking at it overall and looking back on what you did, and it's a remarkable piece of writing. It's very, very well put together. I really have to tell you that. But if someone were to ask you, what is the argument of your book overall, what would you say?
Basically, I wrote it because of Fitzhugh Lee, how a former Confederate showed his loyalty to the United States, and he was a true American. You know, there are little sub things in there, like, you know, about the Spanish-American War, you know, our altruism, supposed our altruism and, you know, our imperialistic tendencies. But the main crux of it is that this man's life and the highlight of his life was, you know, basically he was the man who rode in the saddle of Robert E. Lee, literally and figuratively, and how when he came back from Cuba as American consul, he was a hero. A man named General Lee was a hero to the entire country, and that was amazing to me that something like that happened, and then something I never heard before.
Well, the argument then clearly would be as a united force, we can accomplish so much more than we could if we were divided. And I think that the issue of all of the talents from both sides, from all three sides, based on sectionalism back in the earlier parts of the 19th century, the western part of the United States, the north, east, and the south, when all parts together begin to click and begin to really move forward so much more, better things can be accomplished. The idea of manifest destiny was only fractured by our own fractural interests that broke down the system, at least for several years, 4 years or so. And then, of course, the post-war years, carpetbagging years, and so forth. Peggy, what made the Spanish-American War a splendid little war, like T.R. said one time?
Could you repeat that?
Yeah. Teddy Roosevelt was known to describe the Spanish-American War as a splendid little war. What made this war so splendid?
No, I don't know. Maybe because it was over and done with within a few months.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that makes a lot of sense. It was over very, very quickly. It wasn't something where you had 500,000 people die in the battlefield or anything like that. I think that it was something that was splendid in that it was succinct, it was short, it had a clear purpose. It was doable. Heroes came out of it, and American power begins to flourish into the 20th century.
Yeah, and it's also the reunion between the North and South. And
yes.
You had Southern boys fighting right next to Northern boys, you know?
Yes, yeah.
And during the war, you had, you know, a couple former Confederate generals, you know, including Fitzhugh Lee, as general in the war. And, you know, it was just, hey, we're one big happy family now. Yeah. We are one nation now.
Yeah. What would Fitz say about Cuba today, Peggy?
Oh, he saw a potential in Cuba that has never been realized. You know, when he first got there, he seemed to think it was almost a Garden of Eden that could employ, you know, what, 3 to 4 million people, I think he said. And, you know, at the time, unemployment, I guess, was pretty high here in the States, and thought, you know, it would solve some America's problems. But, you know, he saw after the occupation ended that Cuba started going downhill. And, you know, because he had friends there who he correspond with, and they said, they would tell him things are not going too good here. It's not as good as when the Americans were here and, you know, were helping us out. And as it is today, you know, it's not much better than it was back then.
Yeah. I don't know who's worse, the Spanish or the communists. And also, just as a final remark, I've always wondered about the degree of difficulty in how America can speak about democracy while it acts imperialistically. Does it require imperialism to be democratic? It seems to be an oxymoron, an ironic play on words that just doesn't seem to fit. It's like putting that round peg in a square hole, and it just doesn't seem to, you know, click in there naturally. But anyways, at this point, that's all the time that we have, Peggy. Thank you very, very, very much for sharing your thoughts, your insights, and your opinions regarding our topic for this evening and your book. An excellent read. And now we've come to that final part of our show where I wish to leave all of you with a final thought to consider and to further reflect regarding the signs of our times. Some final thoughts. Fitzhugh Lee lived his life no differently than any other American who found the character to fight and defend the interests of your government for the advancement of a new people in Cuba to live free. We continue to do that today to some diluted extent in the Middle East, as well as other parts of the world. All great countries create their legacies for posterior generations to emulate and live by proudly. But I don't feel the same about America today. I have my reasons to pause when considering its leadership in the world today, its progressive disregard for life as a pro-choice issue, its black racism that further exacerbates and divides our people, its dwindling work ethic as food stamp programs balloon by an ever-increasing welfare state, its deteriorating economic state as evidenced in the anemic unemployment rate, the lethargic housing market, and the continued low interest rates for housing and other loan programs. University students now have to pay benefits and have to pay more in government loans to go to school.
Obamacare stands to stifle our medical benefits in the workplace, and political scandals are rocking the integrity and foundations of our institutions. The moral fabric of what we are is coming loose, and no one is there to rescue us except ourselves. So, what do you want to do? Join me again next Tuesday night at 9 p.m. for another hour of insight by visiting my website at bbsradio.com/historyandyou. Also, please remember to visit and support my Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube links found on the website as follow-ups to each and every program. As your host for this evening's show, this is George Rodriguez Walling, wishing all of you a very pleasant evening. Good night.